Today on Growing Through Grace.
So, Paul before Felix, and I guess we should probably say this is Felix before Paul, because by the time this is all said and done, it is Paul in charge, like he is most of the time, wherever he's at. Sinking ship, he's in charge, giving orders. In prison, he's preaching to kings.
Listening to Growing Through Grace with Pastor Jacob Elam of Morningstar Christian Chapel in Whittier, California. It's good to be back with you as we begin a new week and return to our series in the book of Acts. Today, Pastor Jack will take us to chapter 24 and rejoin Paul as he sits in prison in Caesarea, waiting to face his accusers. Our teacher will give us a helpful review of the events that will lead into today's message. So here's Pastor Jack with a quick look back.
Acts chapter 24. Paul got his wish to finally be able to speak. This was his dream, preach to Jerusalem. And he started off by recounting his conversion, God's calling. He went through the things that the Lord had done for him. Everyone was interested in listening. And then he got to the part where his commission was. So the Lord, Paul said, the Lord told me to go far away from here to the Gentiles. And man, that's the only word that they didn't want to hear. And when the word Gentiles came out, the riot renewed, if you will. Paul was taken into protective custody. And telling the Roman authorities he was a Roman citizen because this guy was about to scourge him to get to the bottom of the problem. The next day, Claudius Lysias, who was the captain, called Paul in along with the Sanhedrin, these religious leaders for the Jews, put them together, wanted to find out what was going on. And Paul realized that this wasn't going to go well. But he also, having been a part of this group, also understood there were half of those people were Sadducees. They didn't believe in the resurrection at all. Half were Pharisees, and they did, believed in heaven and angels. And so he said, I guess I'm on trial for being a Pharisee. And well, half the room was already his now. And there was another big stink, you know, and they had to again pull Paul out away from that, and they kept him locked up. They really didn't know what to do with him. So while Paul was in protective custody, his little nephew found out that there was a plan underway by 40 men to lie in wait when they could get Paul back out to a meeting somewhere, and they would kill him. In fact, they swore they wouldn't eat till he was dead. Little boy finds out about it. I love the way the Lord protects. He comes and tells Paul. Paul sends him to the captain. The captain, you know, real kind of the boy, finds out what's going on and decides, I don't want to keep Paul here. He's in danger. I'm going to send him to Caesarea, the Roman capital of the province. Send him to Felix. He's the guy that is in charge there. And just, you know, have him know exactly what is going on. And so he writes him a letter towards the end of chapter 23, explains what he knows, and then he kind of just hands off Paul to this bigger leader, more powerful man, you know, governor. And he's now to appear before Felix, which is the story, and that's why we're doing the whole chapter. It's just one story in chapter 24. So tonight, Paul before Felix, and I guess we should probably say this is Felix before Paul, because by the time this is all said and done, it is Paul in charge, like he is most of the time, wherever he's at. Sinking ship, he's in charge, giving orders. In prison, he's preaching to kings. Felix might hold the honor in the New Testament of being the guy who wasted more of an opportunity than anyone else to hear from the Lord. His name in history is Antonius Felix. He was the governor of Judea from 52 to 60 AD. He was following in the infamous line of the Pilates. He got his job through his brother Pallas's good friendship with Caesar Augustus. He had the distinction, Felix did, of being the only slave in the Roman Empire that rose to the level of being a king. And so you would think that would have humbled him. It did just the opposite. He went around trying to get even for how he was treated as a kid. He was ruthless. He was cruel. He was wicked. In 60 AD, the Sicarii in that part of the country were rebelling and rioting, and Felix, he brought the army in and just slaughtered lots of folks. He was just horrible to quell the riot. Because of his violence and his brutality, they called him to Rome, and he disappeared. He was done. The same year, by the way, his wife went to Pompeii shopping and died in the eruption of Vesuvius. So this is the family now that is going to be responsible for Paul. Paul, who has been, you know, moved around and kept in different places, and now he finds himself here. So tonight we go with Paul to jail. He's loving Jesus. He's trying to serve the Lord. He's going to go stand before a man who is indecisive and who procrastinate, who's a coward, and who refuses what God offers to him. I think that gets us up to date. Verse 31 of the previous chapter says this. Then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipas. And the next day they left the horsemen to go on with him, and they returned to the barracks. And when he had come to Caesarea, they delivered him with a letter to the governor, presented Paul to him as well. And when the governor has read it, he asked what province he was from. When he found out he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear you when your accusers have come here." And he commanded that Paul be kept in Herod's Praetorium, 65 miles or so away from Jerusalem. Now after 5 days, verse 1, Ananias the high priest came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullus. These gave evidence to the governor about Paul. And when he was called upon, Tertullus began his accusation by saying, "See that through you we are enjoying this great peace and prosperity that is brought to our nation by your foresight. We accept it as always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Therefore, I don't want to be tedious any further, but I beg that you would hear by your courtesy a few words from us." So Paul gets delivered. He is 5 days in hold while the accusers travel the 65 miles from Jerusalem to continue their pressing of their case against Paul. They just hate him because of his lifestyle, because of his commitment. Ananias is the same Ananias that you know from the Gospels. He is probably 80 years old at this time. I think as an 80-year-old guy to make a 65-mile trip, you have to have a lot of hatred in your heart. He brings his elders with him. He brings a high-priced attorney. They descend upon the court in Caesarea like a flock of vultures. This attorney, Tertullus, was apparently really good at navigating the Roman court system for the Sanhedrin. History tells us he spoke fluent Latin. He was known for being ruthless. He represented the interests of these very, very wicked religious men for a high price. I want you to notice, beginning in verse 2, what this lawyer does. He begins by trying to capture the goodwill of the judge by compliments of flattery. If you look at history, there's nothing good you could say about Felix. So the best thing you can do is generalize broadly, right? So he kind of butters him up. He said, "We've had great peace and prosperity by your foresight." In actuality, Felix had done nothing. There was no peace except by force. There were no reforms. He pursued every perversion he could get his hands on, according to Tacitus, who was a first century historian. He'd fit right into our political scene today. Not a good guy. But history tells us that even Felix would eventually kill the high priest Jonathan, who he hated, with a vengeance. Josephus tells us that. For now, he is a first century, he stands before him as this first century kind of dream team. He's giving lawyers a bad name. And I suspect, I don't know about you, I always like to put myself in the middle of what I'm reading, but I suspect that all of the Sanhedrin members had to look at their shoes while he listened to this guy talk. Or they would have started laughing, or, it was as insincere as possible. And to throw it on even thicker, he says in verse 4, "Just give us a few minutes of your time. We don't want to be tedious to you. What a courtesy you've extended to us." Thank you for your courtesy. Thank you for your willingness. And then they turn to just fry an innocent man, because that's why they're there. The charges are no less truthful than they were before. They weren't any more truthful than his lying opening statement. He accuses him on three different grounds, political and religious grounds. Verse 5, we have found this man, speaking of Paul, to be a plague. He's a creator of dissension among the Jews throughout the world, and he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple. We seized him and wanted to judge him according to our own law, but the commander, Lysias, came and with great violence took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you should ascertain all of these things of which we accuse him. And the Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so. The word plague means nuisance, bother, pest. Their accusation of Paul, everywhere he goes, he causes riots. Amongst the Jews around the world, he's an insurrectionist everywhere he goes. Now, you should understand that, at least from a first century Roman standpoint, if you're an insurrectionist, you're one step really close to dead. Because the Romans would put up with a lot, but they wouldn't put out about that at all. If you were causing trouble in the government or standing against Caesar's rulership, there was nothing they disliked more than rebels or troublemakers, especially among captive Jewish people. For that reason, you know, they dealt with sedition very quickly and very decisively. So Tertullus charged that Paul was actively working to overthrow the government of Rome. He's very vague. He's very inflammatory. What he says is untrue, without support. But those are frightening accusations. Don't think for a minute as you read this that Paul just goes, well, that's not true. No. It would chill you to the bone. This is serious business. All over the world, in reality, it seems to me that what we've read in the book of Acts, riots did often follow Paul's preaching, but they weren't started by Paul. They were almost always started by religious folks who hated what Paul was teaching, who were against Jesus Christ and the gospel. These zealous, for years, followed Paul from town to town with only one interest. Let's make sure that we stir up violence and get him moving. And most of Paul's moving, at least the first couple of trips, were because there were crowds wanting to kill him. What was his doing? If you preach and people go nuts, really not your fault. And it certainly wasn't Paul's. So, Tertullus isn't here, though, to seek justice or truth. He's here to win a court case at any cost, right? So, he continues lying through his teeth as he had done when he had made his opening statement, if you like. He said he is a ringleader among those of the Nazarene sect. The word Nazarene means to separate, or to be separate. The term for ringleader is the sect. The word sect is the word for heresy. So he is a leader of the heresy of those who have separated themselves, a contemptible early kind of title for Christians used by Tertullus here. And it seems like he used it in such a way that it must have been well enough understood that he didn't explain it to Felix. Like Felix goes, yeah, I know who they are, or I've heard about them. It didn't seem like this was some kind of a hidden deal. It came out of this whole idea that Jesus was from Nazareth, which was kind of a hick town. And so, you know, remember, was it Nathaniel in chapter 1 that said in John, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? It was just, you know, they took that and used it against the church, if you will. So Paul's standing before this Roman governor with this high-priced hireling on the other side. He's a dissenter among all the Jews, and he's a ringleader of the heresy of those who have separated themselves. They accuse Paul of being a political activist and a religious heretic who is now in charge of a new religious movement to overthrow Rome. Eventually, this persuasion led to the widespread persecution of the saints by the Romans for centuries. It won't be long that we will read of one of the Caesars throwing all of the Jews out of Rome, going against the religious folks, period, forbidding that they could even live in town. But For now, the religious factioning and bitterness was still the case against Paul. By the way, it's still the number one reason for terrorism in the world is religious kind of persuasion. Finally, he said in verse 6, okay, he's a real political activist. He's a sect leader of a worldwide weird religion, a heretic religion. And thirdly, what they had started with, yeah, he tried to profane our temple, and we caught him, and we were just going to deal with him, but your commander, with great violence, took him from us. Not exactly the story I remember reading. It's an untrue rumor, first of all. Second of all, they didn't take him to judge him. They took him to kill him, and this guy, with great violence, came to save his life, right? Rome had given the nation of Israel, if you read history, a lot of leeway to be able to practice their self-imposed religious ways, and even letting them deal with religious law breakers on their own. But this story just doesn't hold water. He took us from us violently. Verse 8, the only thing that's true, he commanded his accuser to come here. So we're asking you to check this out, and I think you're going to see that we're telling the truth, and he's not, and his little partner of you know, head shakers stood there head shaking, and these arrogant liars, you know, standing in darkness trying to accuse an innocent man. I don't know if it's smart to start to go after a Roman leader like the fellow Lysias in Jerusalem in front of the governor. I don't know if that's a smart move or not. Lying and telling this story isn't smart, because you remember from chapter 23 that he's got a letter from the ruler there to tell him what actually happened. So he has the truth from his own guy. And now he's got this lawyer who's, you know, not exactly telling the truth. Meanwhile, behind Tertullus stands all these bobbing heads, right? The elders and Ananias, who came to perjure themselves in the name of serving their God. Religious people can certainly be some of the most unethical people in the world. Zeal without knowledge. Just read about what supposed Christians did during the time of the Crusades, or what Hitler did in the call, you know, the call of the extermination of the Jews, claiming at the same time to be a believer. By the way, believers in Israel will not call themselves Christians because of the identification with their treatment that they got from Hitler. So these are pretty horrible guys. They are demon kind of driven charlatans. They stand to defend one, you know, cubic inch of their religion. But they don't have much to say. They make stuff up. They point their fingers, and they got a bunch of guys doing this. But they got no evidence. They got no testimony. They have no witnesses. Have no proof. They're just mad, and they've been mad for a long time. Now, Felix is a wicked guy, but Felix not a stupid guy. And he's seen right through this bunch. Maybe it takes one to know one, and he did. But he wasn't going to be taken in by these guys. So that's their case has been now presented before Felix. In verse 10, we read, then Paul, after the governor had nodded to him, stood up to speak. And he said, inasmuch as I know that you have been for so many years a judge of this nation, I do more cheerfully answer for myself. Paul has no high-priced lawyer. Paul has no legion of supporters. I think I mentioned to you the animosity was enough in Israel that you would think the church might have come down from Jerusalem and stood on his side of the courtroom, wearing, you know, free Paul shirts or something. There was nobody there. He was alone. He'd have to answer for himself. But the good news is, as a godly man, he had far better representation than these phonies, because Paul would be represented by the Holy Spirit, the parakaleo, the one that comes, you know, in that hour to tell you what you should say, the one he could rely on. Paul also begins with a muted kind of compliment, although he's not trying to butter Felix up. What he does say to Felix is that it's glad that it's him. You've been around the Jews for a lot of years. You understand how things work. You need experience to deal with this nation. You know what the religious zealots are all about and their ways. And so I'm glad it's you. Felix had ruled in Judea for 5 years. He had been an assistant, if you will, to the ruler in Samaria for 4 more. He was really good at Jewish culture, which was complicated and still is. He required, I think it requires experience to understand it. And Paul saw it as a blessing that it was this guy and nobody else. That's all he's saying, right? I'm glad it's you and nobody else. So let me tell you what happened, verse 11, where he says this. because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days ago that I went up to Jerusalem to worship. As far as being a political organizer, who's had the time? I'm a visitor here in town. I got here 12 days ago. 7 days I spent with four guys at the suggestion of James and the Jerusalem church, chapter 21 of Acts, in a vow of commitment. For the last 5 years, I've been here in prison. That certainly doesn't give me much time to organize a new movement. And if you want to check into me, for the last 15 years, I've been living in Cilicia and Pamphylia and in Asia and in Macedonia and Achaia and in Greece and in Ephesus. I've been all over the place, but nowhere near this place, hundreds of miles away. So this is nonsense. And he doesn't carry on much. He said, I haven't been here but 12 days ago, and you can certainly find that out. Verse 12, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone, nor inciting any crowd, neither in the synagogue or in the city, nor can they prove those things of which they now accuse me. If you will, as to the other charges, I just flatly deny them. No riot, no working up the crowd, no problem in the synagogue, no problem in the temple, no problem in the city. They're making charges without proof. Where are their witnesses? And Rome was good in that regard as far as their judicial system. They tended to run them fairly straightforward. Like I said, I wonder where James and the church were, that no one would speak up for Paul and tell him, hey, this is what we said and here's what he did. And he's a faithful guy and hasn't broken any laws. Second of all, as far as being a ringleader of the heresy group, verse 14, but this I will confess to you, that according to the way which they call heresy, a sect, it is that way that I worship the God of my fathers, believing all of the things which have been written in the law and written in the prophets. And I have hope in God, which they themselves will also accept, that there will be a resurrection from the dead, both of the just and of the unjust. Look, I'm hardly in a cult, that's what he says. I confess that I am a way follower. It was a title that you find a few times in the Bible for the believers who would follow Jesus, who was the way. But Paul tied that belief system intricately with that and the Old Testament beliefs of the Jews, that there's one God and he promised a Savior, and there's no disconnect between the Old Testament and the New Testament experience. So to Paul, Christianity wasn't contrary to the law, was the fulfillment of the law. It wasn't contrary to the prophets. Was the fulfillment of the prophets. It was the extension of what God had begun. They called it a sect. They called it heresy. Paul said, I believe everything that's written in the scriptures. And he almost looked at the guy and said, I think they believe that too. And here I am on trial for believing God's word and in the hope that I have of the resurrection from the dead. That, again, puts half of them on his side. I believe in the law, I believe in the prophets, I believe in the writings of Moses regarding the Messiah. I believe that he was supposed to be born in Bethlehem. I believe he's born to a virgin. I believe he's going to suffer and die the third day. I believe he's going to ascend and he's coming again. I believe it all. Now, you should understand that the scribes and the Pharisees, of which most of these people were a part, interpreted the Bible any way they wanted. They didn't go to it for truth. They used it to sell their truth. You've probably heard a lot of people saying, just live your truth. It's like a catchphrase today. It's an idiotic idea. Because there's only one truth. It's God's truth. So live his truth. If your truth ain't his truth, you ain't got truth. It's my new slogan I'm putting on the shirt. I don't know if it'll fit, but I like it already.
And with that thought, we'll stop there for today and pick up the balance of Acts chapter 24 the next time we're together. This has been the first part of a two-part study taught by Pastor Jack Abelin. If you'd like to get the entire message, we do have that available for you. All you need to do to order, simply contact us and ask for study number 3084. That's always helpful for us to know the radio station that you're listening to, so be sure to mention those call letters when you get a hold of us. And as we're studying through the book of Acts, we'd like to let you know that we have all of Pastor Jack's teachings through the book of Acts on a single MP3 USB flash drive. Well, this way you can go back and listen to any previous studies, or you can stop and start, or you can share these amazing studies of the Acts of the First Century Church with a friend or family member. So if you'd like to order Pastor Jack's studies through the book of Acts, all in the MP3 format on a single USB flash drive, or to get today's study, just dial our toll-free phone number at 866-88-GRACE. That's 866-884-7223. Again, that's 866-884-7223. You can also order by mail. Just address your letter to Growing Through Grace, P.O. Box 1954, Whittier, California, 90609. Or this and all of our resources are available online at growingthroughgrace.com. Again, that's growingthroughgrace.com. And that's going to wrap up our time together today. We do thank you for being with us. So until next time, as you daily walk with our Lord Jesus Christ, may you continue to grow in His grace. Growing Through Grace is a listener-supported ministry brought to you by Morningstar Christian Chapel in Whittier, California, a Calvary Chapel outreach.